This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
By way of introduction of today's show, we had the renowned Arizona historian Jack August on this show several months ago. And we asked him who he thought the best governor was in the history of the state of Arizona. And I thought I knew what was coming, but I didn't know for sure. And his answer was Bruce Babbitt. And I asked him why, and he said water. And 1980, there was a groundwater act that was path-breaking. One of our guests today, Kathy Farrest, is by most accounts responsible for making that act a reality.
So she's someone we should all be thankful for.
Every yes. time we drink a glass of water.
Darn right.
She's here along with Tom Bushansky, who is director of the State Water Department of Water Resources. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You hear various discussions of, well, we're in a desert, therefore it's a problem. Or conversely, you hear, well, we used to be agriculture, and I know that when you convert agriculture to suburban use, it's a huge net gain of water, so there's no problem. I want to get people to understand, and myself included, tell me, use some metric, I don't know, acre feet or something, how much water is there? Or let me ask first about an analogy. And tell me if my analogy is correct. My analogy would be this. You've got rain, most of which ends up in the watershed and ends up in rivers. That's sort of like income. You've got the amount, total amount we use. That's expenditures. And then you have sitting water that's in the ground. And I see that like a bank account. And sort of one is it comes every year. The rainwater, if it goes through the river and out, if you don't use it, it's gone. Unless, I guess, you pump it into groundwater. What you use, you use. Is that a good analogy for what we have to work with and what we use, income outflow and resources? Is that fair?
I think it's a fair analogy, other than the fact when the river water flows through the rivers, it's not gone. Mm-hmm. It infiltrates into the ground and increases that bank account. Mm-hmm. And we have ways to also artificially increase that bank account by moving surface water sources from their source to places where we can put it under the ground.
So if we don't use the Colorado River water, we keep it, we get to put it somewhere?
We passed laws in the 80s and then again in the 90s that allow us to store that unused Colorado River water underground. Mm-hmm. And we have been doing that for decades. So okay. we've stored about 9 million acre feet okay. of unused Colorado River water. Right. And
that's one of my three. That's one of my three questions then. Okay,
don't paint over that. For people that don't know, including myself included, and I've talked about groundwater for a while in real estate and 100 years use, things like that. It sounds like a vault. It sounds like there's some vault underground that we just throw water into. What is that?
No, it isn't. And that's one of the disconnects. Because we can't see underground, people don't understand what it looks like.
Right.
But it's not a big bathtub. So it's different layers of sand and gravel, and some of those layers can actually store water. And different parts of the valley can store more water than other parts of the valley. So in the Phoenix area, we have a big alluvial plain where over centuries, water was stored underground, and that is our fossil groundwater.
Is 9 million acre feet what we've added to it, or is that the total amount down there?
That's what we've added over the years since okay. our underground storage program
so
began.
So we are actually adding to our total supply rather than subtracting from it?
That is one method to add to our supply, but we're extracting at the same time.
Mm-hmm. But I'm saying net.
And so
net,
the net effect depends on where you are in Arizona.
Okay, but overall, statewide, are we adding to or taking from right now?
So if you look at our statewide, we have groundwater in storage in Arizona's basins, alluvial basins, was depleted by more than almost 75 million acre-feet between 1940 and 2007, meaning that water was taken out and not replenished.
Now, that was from when to when?
It was from 1940 to 2007. So okay. What we see is in many areas of the state where we are taking far more groundwater out than is actually being replenished. Okay. Remember, a lot of this groundwater was stored centuries ago, hundreds of millions of years ago. And when it's taken out, and it's not, it's very difficult to replenish it by natural means.
Okay, so how big is the bank? How much is in there?
Well, it depends on where you are. So
statewide?
I'm going to defer to Tom on that. But
and I don't have an exact number, but it's tens of millions of acre feet.
Okay, tens of millions. Now, the other two questions, how much do we get every year coming in and how much are we using each year?
So I don't have the numbers exactly of what the recharge is into the groundwater table every year, but I can tell you that the total groundwater we pump as a percentage of our total demand, which is about 7 million acre feet. Again, an acre foot can serve a family of four, two families of four, maybe a little bit more than that, but two families of four, rule of thumb. 40% of our water is groundwater. 40% is from the Colorado River, a renewable supply. 17% is from other rivers inside the state, the Salt River, for example, that runs through Phoenix. And then about 3% from reuse of reclaimed water, treated wastewater.
I'm looking at river. The two of those numbers, the river and the rainwater, that's that we get that every year. But the 40% that's pumped out of groundwater, that's net withdrawal?
That is the total percentage of our 7 million acre foot total use.
I do not have
a number for you about what the net.
You know, in other words, I'm using this analogy. We got this bank account. Are we withdrawing more than we're putting in every year?
So let me offer this to help people understand. In the Phoenix and Tucson metropolitan areas, which are regulated under the 1980 Groundwater Code, 77% of the state's population lives there, and almost 40% of the total demand exists in those areas. We are at a point where we're taking out as much as is going back into the ground naturally and artificially.
It's in balance.
Today. We're
it's
in balance today in those areas of the state. In other areas of the state, we're not in that same balance.
Meaning we're taking out more.
We're taking out more.
Where is the takeout more? What areas?
So it would be Pinal County, and it would be central, western, and northwestern Arizona, and southeastern Arizona, northeastern Arizona. Again, outside of the main metropolitan corridors.
We're keeping the theme here going on with some music beds. This is probably the most important topic we've had here on the Think Tank. We've gone politics, we've gone history. This is water. This is very, very important. More next, right here on the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are back with our water experts here, Kathy Ferris and Tom Bushanske. My takeaway was there's areas of the state that are in balance, which means if we don't change anything, we're okay. That's including Maricopa and Pima both. The two metropolitan areas, is that correct?
Essentially, yes.
Okay. But other areas we're taking out. All right, when I hear that we're taking out, then my question becomes, at what rate and at what point do they go dry? Is that...
So, let's just take an example. There's a basin called the Wilcox Basin, which is in Cochise County. And I think the figures are that they're withdrawing about five times more groundwater than is annually replenished.
Okay.
So you can see that the depletion rate is pretty great. And because of that, they're...
Depending on how big the bank is.
Well, that's correct. That's correct. But farmers down there are worried about it. Mm-hmm. They're worried that they're having to drill their wells deeper, subsidence is cracking well casings. Domestic wells are growing dry, and there's a group of folks down there that are trying to address that problem with creating a different kind of management structure for down there. But it requires state law to change. Mm-hmm. It requires the legislature to do something. Mm-hmm. And the reason why we're in such good shape in the Phoenix metropolitan area is because we have the Groundwater Management Act. If we had not passed that law in 1980, we would be in the same shape as Wilcox and some of these other areas.
You know, I'm realizing one thing. I was pushing you to answer statewide, and your answers were coming back, well, this area and this area. Maybe my premise was wrong. This is, you can't distribute water from anywhere to anywhere else. They're really separate systems. Is that a fear?
That is absolutely correct. We have regions of the state, and in fact, the Department of Water Resources, and I'm sure Tom will want to talk about this, has created and designated 22 separate planning areas because our areas are so diverse.
They're independent systems. I think of CAP tunnels and all that, and that doesn't go everywhere, I guess, is the...
Absolutely not. Okay. It only serves, you know, Maricopa, Pima, and Pinal County.
Okay. So could we go back history? And Kathy, could you talk us through the 1980 Groundwater Act? What was happening? What produced it? And what did the act do?
So, you know, for decades, Arizona had known that it was, we call it mining groundwater, just like you mine a coal supply or copper. We were taking our groundwater out faster than being replenished, and we had a overdraft rate that was really significant. But it wasn't until a farmer in Pima County sued copper mines in the city of Tucson and said you can't pump groundwater and transport it to where you need it, that enough of a crisis was created to get the legislature to act. So the legislature created a Groundwater Management Study Commission, and the idea was to redo the state's groundwater laws. And it took Governor Bruce Babbitt stepping in to mediate the negotiations among the warring interests to create this act. And so what the act did is it just changed the paradigm completely. It said groundwater is not a private property right. You have to have a right from the state to use it.
Just because I own a plot of land doesn't give me an unlimited right to put a drill in and take as much water as I can get.
That's absolutely right. And we grandfathered in existing users. But then we said if you want to initiate a new use of groundwater in the future, if you want to drill a new well, you have to get a permit from the Department of Water Resources. We also said we have too much agriculture. So we can't allow any more new agriculture to come into existence in these areas.
What about type of agriculture? If somebody has an agricultural plot right now and it's a relatively low water use plot, do they have the right to switch it to a high use plot?
No, because we have conservation requirements for all water users, including agriculture. So they have Tom will add into this, but they have an amount of water they can use, and then they have to determine how to put that to use. So we don't try to regulate the type of crop. We try to regulate the amount of water.
Amount of water, same thing. Yeah, I mean, in other words, you can't go from, and I don't know what's high and what's low, but I'm an urban boy, but basically you can't take a low water use thing and just, you know, because there's more profit in almonds or something like that that's high, you can't switch it without.
And actually you can do that. And the flexibility that the farmers have is they have a total number of acres, they have a total volume of water. They could reduce the number of acres
and use
that total amount of water. That gives them the flexibility to deal with the market conditions.
Sure.
They're there to make money. They don't want to go out of business. So that is the flexibility that was built in to the groundwater code. And I want to make the point that the groundwater code is not this magical static thing that was created in 1980 and just sits there now. Mm-hmm. It's been changed over the years as issues have arisen, and we've been able to build consensus to make those changes. One of the changes that occurred a little less than 10 years ago was areas outside the active management areas, these populous areas that were the target of the groundwater code, those areas
active
now—
Active management area, are they their metropolitan areas?
And that is the Tucson to Phoenix corridor, essentially, and then around Prescott. But those areas that were not initially regulated by the groundwater code in the last decade now have requirements. Any water provider that has 15 or more connections has to have a drought management plan and a water conservation plan in place that was added to the groundwater code. So we've improved things over the years. The recharge underground storage programs were added and tweaked over the years, over the last 20 years in the code. So Kathy's discussion of what's going on in Wilcox and the potential to have a new paradigm there for managing the water supplies, again, would need to be put into the law, but it shows that the folks in that area stood up and said, we see an issue here. They reached out to the department to help facilitate their discussions. It's their process, not ours, but we've given them help, and it remains to be seen how far down the path they are towards a legislative proposal.
Are we the Michael Jordan state? When it comes to water, are we the one? Are we the model that other states should follow, and they're just not?
We are the Michael Jordan state when it comes to water management, especially water conservation, controlling our groundwater pumping in these active management areas, and the reuse of reclaimed water. And we've seen in California, only when this drought impacted them in a very negative way, agriculture drying up and towns going dry in central California, they implemented their own groundwater code in 2014. We did it in 1980. So we're far ahead. And our recharge program is another thing that is very unique and influential, and folks around the country come to us asking us about that recharge program.
Did California? They're in crisis mode at this point, right? Are they coming over and asking, guys, how do we manage this?
So I think they have looked at us and looked at our programs, but we interact with them on a regular basis. So okay. They've known about this for a long time. We work with them.
Some of those interactions were lawsuits, weren't they?
Some of those were, but we have a new day, and that's the day of collaboration between California and Arizona.
It's funny the crisis brings some people together.
I remember there was this lawsuit called Arizona v. California.
Oh, yes.
Well, the different paradigm towards collaboration started probably about 15 years ago with the states on the Colorado River.
Right. All right. We are talking all things water and water history. And now let's move forward a little bit. Let's see what's coming up for Arizona. And let's talk about that dreaded D word. Oh, yeah. It's the drought. We'll talk about that a little later right here on KTAR News.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're talking all things water. I want to ask Kathy Ferris, as I listened to the last discussion and heard you say basically we did some stuff that was really sensible policy, and the thing that struck me is you only get to sensible policy through political compromise. How on earth did, because there's interest at the table, and as I'm sure you know better than I do, how did you pull that off?
So I like to say that, I'd like to concur with your previous guest who talked about Governor Babbitt. He was brilliant. And, but he wasn't just brilliant on his own. He was briefed by me, I might say, daily on what was going on. So that when the water interest came to him and said, we need your help, he was ready to step in.
Which interest? Farming interest?
It was the farms, mm-hmm. copper mines, and the cities.
Okay.
And they—
people that are concerned or understood the problem and knew what the consequence of the tap running dry.
That's right. And they were also very skilled men, and they were all men. They were skilled negotiators. They were, many of them, lawyers. And they were very smart, and they knew that they had to do something, especially because the Secretary of the Interior had said, if you don't pass a Groundwater Management Act, then the Central Arizona Project is going to be stalled. We're not going to fund
that's
it.
That's a big threat.
A big threat. Of course, that threat was orchestrated by Bruce Babbitt.
Uh-huh.
But it played out beautifully. And so you had
Who was Interior Secretary then?
Cecil Andrus.
Uh-huh.
And he
Idaho, wasn't he?
Idaho. And he and Bruce Babbitt had a long, cordial relationship. And so he basically said, we need you to threaten us, and I'll complain, but you need to do it.
Theater.
Yeah. And it happened. And these folks came together. And plus, we had a legislature that was willing to say, we're going to let you do this work. And when it came back to the legislature with Burton Barr, who was the majority leader of
the House.
I have
a mental image of Bruce Babbitt sitting in Burton Barr's outer office waiting for his turn.
Yeah, well, not quite.
Not quite.
Not quite.
Yeah.
Burton Barr said, we're not going to allow you to amend this, okay? Mm-hmm. Folks, this is the deal that's been cut. It's been worked on for 3 years. No amendments. And it passed in a one-day special session without a single amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Never would see that happen again, I don't believe.
Politics when politics worked,
yes,
is what it sounds
exactly.
like.
Yes,
Well, and I would also like to think that there is a vision of the economic future of the state mm-hmm. as a whole, and they embrace that vision. Mm-hmm. And again, water and the economy are the same thing. Mm-hmm. No water, no economy. And we needed to have they realized to get their water act together, that was going to allow the economic vitality of Arizona to increase over time. And a couple of statistics from between 1957 and 2014, our water use has actually gone down 100,000 acre feet.
Is that because of diminished agricultural percentage?
Because of conservation programs and partly because of agriculture converting to rooftops.
Can you roughly, is it mostly, can you put percentages
I don't have percentages, but to add to that story, in that same time period, our population has gone up over six times mm-hmm. in our gross economic indicator has gone up 19 times. So it's a great story. And again, I think people need to understand those connections and how well we've done. And that story really is a combination of all these things we've done, the groundwater code, changing uses from agriculture to municipal and industrial, all the things that have helped Arizona move forward. And that's what we're looking to do for the future, to keep mm-hmm. that same trend going.
Water rights, if my limited understanding is legally a highly convoluted thing, isn't it? I mean, I hear phrases like...
Well, not if you're a water lawyer. Right. I think it's rather simple. It's really important and to understand that water in Arizona, groundwater and in-state surface water, is really a public resource. Mm-hmm. And so the way you are able to use it is by obtaining a right in most cases. Our surface waters, you have to have a right from the Department of Water Resources or a court decree. And our groundwater in regulated areas.
Isn't surface water, isn't there something called prior appropriation?
Yes,
if I've been taking water off the Colorado River for years in my family and generations, I have some continued right to do so.
Well, it's not the Colorado River, because the Colorado River as an interstate river is governed by the Secretary of the Interior and by federal law. But for example, for the Salt River, yes, and the Verde mm-hmm. River, yes. It's first in time, first in right.
So my family had a farm in Mesa, and I was pulling. I assume however much you pull, it doesn't give you unlimited rights, right?
You technically, since 1919, had to go to the state, to uh-huh. a state agency, and say, I want to start appropriating and diverting water.
And you got a permit
And you
for
had
that.
To get a permit.
In perpetuity, once you get it, do you keep it?
There are use it or lose it conditions mm-hmm. that most of which really have never been implemented. Part of the reason is we don't have a very good track record of keeping track of the priority of all of our surface water rights. And that's part of the reason we're in something called the general stream adjudications. If you want to get arcane and really have your people's eyes glaze over, you start talking about this general stream adjudication, which is a massive proceeding. There's two of them in state court to determine the relative priority of all of these claims to surface water.
Okay. This is another lawyer's relief act.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm the only lawyer in the state that doesn't participate in the general adjudications, and I am so thrilled about that.
She was looking at me when she was talking about people's eyes glazing over. Yes.
So how much of our water overall is agriculture versus residential use?
So, again, based on our 7 million acre feet per year mm-hmm. use, agriculture uses 73% of that. Mm-hmm. Municipal uses 21%, and industrial uses 6%.
Okay, so 73% agriculture. I assume that number has been dropping over the
decades. It has over time. I think 20 years ago, we were probably 84%, 85%.
Okay, but still high.
It's still significant, and people should understand it's a very robust part of our economy. Arizona is uniquely situated for agriculture, and it's a $17.1 billion a year economy for agriculture in the state of Arizona.
But the mental picture I have is long-term trend is there's agricultural acreage that's going to end up suburban, and that the bonus for this, one of the bonus for the state on the, in that conversion, we get back, we have net water gain.
So I agree that there will be agricultural converting into municipal industrial over time, but I think there will be parts of the agricultural community where that's going to either not happen or not happen for a long time. So the Yuma area, which grows all of the green leafy vegetables for North America, 85% for North America between November and April, they have very high value. There's no place else in the United States that can repeat or replace that. Their per acre value of that is exponentially higher than other places in the Western United States. So that probably won't convert as quickly.
Mm-hmm. It's also not contiguous to the two metropolitan areas.
That's right.
So how big a role is conservation? Well, I guess we'll deal with that when we can start dealing with that now. How big is conservation in the overall picture? How much is done? How much do we save on some percentage basis? And what's the capacity to do more?
So we have, since the 1980 Groundwater Management Act, been implementing mandatory water conservation in our AMAs. And then Tom talked about what has been done later outside of AMAs. But it's very difficult to quantify the actual amount of water conserved. We know that a significant amount has been conserved. We know, for example, from the moving forward process of the Colorado River Basin Water Supply and Demand Study that was done by the federal government, that in the per capita use rates in central Phoenix have decreased by 15% since 2000. These numbers are very hard, though, to quantify. And we know, though, for example, the city of Phoenix has done much better than that. Between 1991 and 2013, their per capita use rate decreased by 29%.
Wow.
So it's really good. It's really good.
So instead of the five C's, we should add a sixth C, right? Conservation. Check us out. Look at us being all green and all that good stuff. All right, let's see. Can I break the rules and keep them around? Usually Doc and I argue in battle in the fourth segment, but I want to bring these guys back because I did promise the D word. I do have some drought questions for the both of you when we come back right here on The Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Kathleen Ferris is the Executive Director of Arizona Municipal Water Users Association, and we have Tom Bushansky here. He's the Director of the State Department of Water Resources, probably two of the most important people, both in Arizona state history and currently involved in the one topic that all of us have in common, and that is water in the great state of Arizona. We're looking at our neighbors to the west, and California is in bad shape, at least what we see in the media. It might be media hype. I don't know what it is, but they are suffering through the big D word, a drought. What the heck happened in California? How do you get into a drought as a state?
So the drought in California really is occurring because water is collected in Northern California, in the mountains, in the Sierra Nevadas. They've had almost no snowpack. The allocations that normally would occur in the 50 to 60% range under their contracts last year were zero. I think next year is projected to be 15%.
Allocations mean?
Allocations of the available water in the State Water Project in Northern California, water that is created from snow melt and rain stored in reservoirs.
Normally 60 went down to zero.
Right. That water moves into the Central Valley below San Francisco, but it also moves all the way down to Southern California, LA, San Diego, et cetera. In Southern California, they have Colorado River water, so they're surviving pretty well. But in the Central Valley, where those allocations have been cut down, hundreds of thousands of acres of farmland have gone out of production. Mm-hmm. Unemployment rates are skyrocketing. At the same time, we've suffered from the same drought conditions, but because of things like the groundwater code, increasing efficiencies, we have not had to do those mandatory cutbacks that Governor Brown announced in California on last April 1st. So again, we were out ahead of California to some degree because of our management schemes. We weren't hit as hard in terms of reduced runoff and snowpack internally in our state. And our Colorado River water supplies have not been impacted either, even though the elevations of Lake Mead, people see the white ring around the lake.
Yes.
The lake's dropping, but there's still enough water in there that we haven't had to have any cutbacks.
Is there a, are you concerned about the trend on that?
We are concerned about the trend. We've actually taken actions. The seven states who share the river, and particularly California, Nevada, and Arizona, the states below Lake Mead, to keep water conserved in Lake Mead through various conservation actions. There's a couple of different programs that are going on. Of course, that takes some money, and that takes some foresight for the people who enter into the conservation programs. But we've probably have about 3 to 5 feet of water in Lake Mead that wouldn't otherwise be there. Mexico actually has helped. They've got some of their water stored in Lake Mead. So that's an area that we continue to work on to try to increase our capability to conserve that water in Lake Mead to slow the drop and hopefully...
They have some rights to Colorado River water by treaty.
Yes, there's a 1944 treaty that gives Mexico 1.5 million acre feet of water. By comparison, Arizona has 2.8 million acre feet of Colorado River water.
Mm-hmm. Now, as the team captain, really, as the Michael Jordan of the crew here, are there any states that share the Colorado? Are there any states that aren't playing ball, or does everyone get it?
Everyone gets it.
Okay,
but I will say it's very difficult within each state. The same kind of discussions that went on through the groundwater code, those sectors of water users in each state, they have their own view of the world. They have their own priority of water rights. So it takes a lot of time and careful negotiation to come up with these plans to make these things happen.
Are we at any political risk? I look at we are, by the picture you painted, in relatively good shape at the moment. California is in drought. There's the Colorado River water, which we share with California. I know the size of the California congressional delegation relative to Arizona. Are we at political risk that they're going to try to grab a bigger share?
So I think when we make those kind of comments, California, of course, says it's paranoia. You're always at political risk, I guess, when there are crises in one state and not in the other. I did testify in Congress at a Senate drought oversight hearing in June. Part of my testimony was, please make sure that the federal government doesn't help California in a way that hurts Arizona. Mm-hmm. There are ways they can help them without hurting Arizona. There are ways we've helped California, and we'll continue to look for those things. But that specter is always out there.
Now, there's been, during this presidential election that we're creeping up on in these campaigns that are ramping up, Carly Fiorina took it to California and said, well, they wouldn't have this problem if they weren't saving a little fish called the Delta Smelt and running runoff water into the ocean. How close to the mark was she?
So that's very close to the mark. The numbers over the last 5 or 6 years of the amount of water that has flowed to the sea for the Delta Smelt and salmon is something like 4 million acre feet. The other issue is that...
Is that annual or is that total?
That's total over about the last 5 or 6 years in California. Those issues and the environmental movement in California have also stopped new storage from being built in California that could capture some of that water that goes to the ocean. They could probably, with more storage, meet their fish requirements and also increase the amount of usable water they can create through more storage. But those things have been on the books for years over there. They get no traction in actually becoming able to build those things and get through all the environmental compliance at either at the federal or state level.
So we're in a situation where it is very tough to build new dams or to make changes to environmental laws. And, you know, those laws are in place for good reasons in many cases. I mean, we saw a dam in Arizona, Cliff Dam, get nixed for environmental reasons, and we were able to work around that. So what has to happen, I think, is reasonable people have to come together and figure out alternative solutions to some of these things that other people believe will create harm to species and to the environment.
So you're saying we got to take a look at building some dams? Is that?
I don't know that I'm saying that. I don't know enough about California's situation up there to opine on that. I just know here in Arizona, I have a hard time seeing us building any new huge structures to store water.
Well, and I'd like to throw in this little tidbit because it's probably counterintuitive, but President Obama's 2013 climate change plan, it says we need more storage to adapt to climate change for both the water users and the environment. And again, that probably comes as a surprise to a lot of people that the Democratic administration, very pro-environment, would have that in their own plan.
That storage equals environment, whereas some of the opposition to storage is environmental.
Why oppose?
You have to think about storage, too. I mean, we've done the creative thing and store the water underground. Mm-hmm. And we've had the ability to do that. We have a different situation, of course, than California. Mm-hmm. But that's perfect storage. It doesn't harm anybody. Mm-hmm. The water doesn't evaporate.
Is it some of that geology? I mean, do you have the option to do that everywhere, or are we just blessed with a good geological structure that permits us? Is that equally permittable or feasible in other places like California?
We are very blessed with the geologic structures that allows us to do that. And the analogy really is underground. It's like a sponge. If you see a sponge sitting on the sink and it's full of water, you wouldn't know it is until you pushed your finger on it and the water popped out. That's what a well does. The equivalent of pushing your finger and having the water pop out. So we have these huge alluvial basins. You look at the mountains around Phoenix. In the middle, it's a giant basin that's filled in with sediment over the years. Has huge capability to hold a lot of water.
Do you want to leave us with final thoughts?
Well, you know, this discussion is wonderful because it's facts. And I think one of the things that has been of concern to me, I've been working in this area for 38 years, is when a drought comes or when people are concerned, there's a lot of noise out there about what our real water supply situation is. And it's really a whole lot better than a lot of people think. But I also want to say that doesn't mean that we should stop worrying about it. We are in this position because we have worried.
And we do have something called the Governor's Water Initiative, announced by Governor Ducey on October 5th. It charges the Arizona Department of Water Resources with looking forward, looking at what the issues are statewide, and coming up with some solutions.
Both of you, thank you. So for what you've done, what you're doing, amazing work. And on behalf of the entire state, thank you very, very much. That's a wrap for us right here on the Think Tank, KTAR News.